get started. I'm supposed to use the microphone. Where is it? Okay. Hi, I'm Mindy Levin. I'm rushing you today because I have to leave early. I have to catch a flight at 6 o'clock. All right. They told me to use this. Is this being recorded or something? Aha. Okay, then I'll be careful what I say. So I'm going to do two different presentations today, basically about clinical practice guidelines for upper limb. I'm just trying to turn it off. Okay. For upper limb rehabilitation and stroke. And then I'm going to get a little more specific about what we actually do for that upper limb rehabilitation. And as you know, it's a domain that spans both PT and OT. Doesn't always have a home, or it has a home everywhere, as it should. It's a multidisciplinary kind of thing. So I'm first going to talk about clinical practice guidelines. Please feel free to interrupt, discuss while we're going on. But at 3 o'clock, I stop. I got to get out. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to talk about general clinical You've done clinical practice guidelines for a stroke? Okay, so maybe you've seen some of this? Perhaps. Well, tell me if it's too repetitive, we'll just skip through. But I just want to acknowledge that this work is really from, most of the slides are stolen from Robert Teasel, with his blessing. You know who he is? Okay, he's sort of the mover and shaker behind the evidence-based stroke research review. And maybe a lot of you may have been involved in some of that. So, you know that stroke, how much do I have to repeat? I don't know. Anyway, you know that stroke is a big problem and upper limb is a really big problem. But the bottom line is that the upper limb, I mean, from a therapeutic perspective, the upper limb deficits persist well beyond the acute phase into the chronic phase. And they may actually get worse with time because people use their arm less than they should. And this is the issue. How do we get these guys to use their arm more? So, you know that the focus of rehab in the early stages is what in stroke? Mobility. Get somebody out, get somebody moving, get somebody home, right? So the first focus is on the lower limb and on mobility. Trunk balance, cognitive factors, orientation and so forth, and walking. The second focus is on the upper limb. And in the acute stage, we hardly even, aside from positioning and prevention of let's say, spasticity, aside from that, there's not much active rehab that's done with the upper limb. Now, do you think that's a good thing? No, it's not a good thing, of course. But, I mean, it's a necessity of the system. The system says we want to get people out as soon as possible. If we focus very much on the upper limb and not on the lower limb, then they'll be in the hospital longer, and that's not what the system wants. So it's kind of because of the way the system focuses that it changes how we approach things. Okay? So what are the goals for early OT for upper limb? For stroke? Never mind upper limb. What are early OT goals? Early stroke goals for OTs. Yeah, the first things you do, when the patient's in the hospital, what do you do first? You focus on the upper limb? Focus on finger movement? No. What do you focus on? Positioning? Orientation? Cognitive? A little bit more, right? So the focus is on getting somebody comfortable, aware of where they are, and ready to meet the challenges of what they're up to, you know, the cognitive challenges. You do a cognitive assessment for neglect, for other things like apraxia, right? What is the early OT, what are the early PT goals? Acute stroke. How many PTs are here? Okay, so you guys, what's the early PT goals? Positioning, transfers, safe transfers. Positioning is positioning to avoid contractures, subluxation, or secondary problems. That's right. Okay. What's next? Trunk balance, right? Standing, mobility, right? Weight shifting. Do you work on the upper limb? not in the first, not in the acute phase. Forgot to mention for OT in the acute phase, it's about ADLs. Yes, it's about, okay? So what about the upper limb? It gets left behind. That's my whole point. The upper limb gets behind. And by the time we get to it, we may not be able to access its potential. That's the problem. That's my crying, you know, cry to arms call. Okay, I think that we need to access this brain plasticity early. We know that the most rapid changes occur in the first 3 months, but we're not getting to the arm that much in the first 3 months. In fact, most of the research and focus of interventions for the upper limb are occurring after that period of time, maybe at post 6 weeks or, you know, into that subacute phase. So we don't have the research and we don't have the evidence to say, one of the big problems is we don't have the evidence to say that if we access that upper limb early, we'll have better outcomes. It sort of makes sense, but we don't have the research. Okay? Because first, it's very hard to do research in the acute phase. Patients have other priorities. The health system has other priorities. So here I am. I'm going to go into the hospital with a VR system and say, okay, you've got to play VR games 60 minutes a day, and you've got to do this, and you've got to do that, when really the important thing is to make sure they have good personal hygiene, right? So this is the problem. This is having to know, trying to get the evidence to prove to the health system that it's worth making the effort to do the upper limb rehab early. And that's what we're still trying to do, okay? We do have evidence that if we do more rehab for the upper limb, intensive, all those things about plasticity, then we will have better outcomes, even in the chronic stage. So that's very positive. But maybe the increments that we're going to get in the chronic stage are not as good as those that we can get in the acute stage. But we have to prove that still, okay, to the healthcare system. Okay, you get it? So that's what that is all about. But so if you look at the evidence, you see this line, and this line really annoys me. It says, rehabilitation of the upper limb is not as successful as that of the lower limb. And it's probably because of all those reasons I just said. We're not getting to it early enough. We're not able to give enough treatment to really access the plastic changes, the potential plastic changes in the brain. But that's why the new technologies have been coming up. Okay, so why do we need these new technologies? Why aren't we getting into the rehab early for the upper limb? Aside from the therapists have different, clinicians have, or the hospital system or the system has different priorities, there's also just not enough time, and there's not enough people. But there is enough time from the patient perspective. How much time is the patient sitting in the hospital doing nothing? A big time, a big amount of time, okay? But the clinicians are busy, busy, busy. It's not them. Right? So if we can find ways of getting the patient self-motivated and doing stuff on their own, but good stuff, not just way of flailing their arms around. Okay, this is my other bias, and I'll get to that. But if we get them to do the right things at the right time, on their own, maybe with family assistance or caregiver assistance, then that would maybe answer this or address this problem, this gap that we have in treatment. Okay, so that's where robotics and VR is coming in, and tele-rehab and things like that, that we can use technology to access patient hours that we don't usually have access to. Okay, I'm never going to finish by three if I can't get past the first slide. So in rehab, motor rehab, what's relevant? We know that about the plasticity story, that sensory motor improvement results from experience-dependent plasticity in the CNS. It's not just random plasticity. It depends on use. So if you do the right thing, you'll get the right outcome. If you do the wrong thing, you'll get the wrong outcome, right? The story of compensation recovery. Do you know the story about learned non-use? You know the story about learned bad use, okay? The same group, well, I mean, the concept of learned non-use, you know, comes from Taub, and it's led to this idea of forced use paradigm, or the CIMT, the constraint-induced paradigm. But also, we've been arguing, and it's been known from, let's say, motor control perspective, that the system will always find sort of self-reorganize in the motor, its motor ability, in order to do a task that it wasn't able to do before, but using different effectors or doing it in a different way. You understand all that? Okay. What about this? So if I want to reach for a cup and I can't do this, I'll do this. But I'm still reaching for the cup, and I'm still accomplishing the task, but I'm compensating. Okay? So in other words, the system will cheat. The motor system will find new ways to combine different degrees of freedom, the motor control system, in order to accomplish the task based on what it wants to accomplish. So left on its own, bless you, the system will compensate. Right? The system will find a solution. The question is that a good solution or a bad solution? It's a good solution if there's no other way that the system will ever possibly be able to do this. In other words, if somebody has no return in the upper limb. So even the ability to use the limb to do anything would be great. Okay, so we just accept that. But if there's potential for improvement, we have to be able to access that, identify it, and access it. Okay? So the idea here is to not let the system cheat when there's potential for allowing recovery to occur in a natural, in a better way. Okay? This is a big issue. I know this isn't about CP, but in CP. Because the CP system is totally reorganized. They're in children with cerebral palsy. They don't have ever any sort of normal patterns there to match to. So everything they do is compensatory. So then what is normal movement in atypical populations? What is a normal movement for an abnormal nervous system? This is a big issue, okay? But we're not going to get to that. If we want the system, we know that if we let the system practice no matter the way it wants to, it will cheat. It will do something that might be simpler, easier, more comfortable, takes less energy or whatever, for what other reason. But what happens when you practice the wrong task is that the brain reorganizes to optimize that wrong task, and it's called learn bad use. And this has been demonstrated by Teresa Jones and Alahash Ver, I cannot pronounce his name, because it's Alahash and the Vili at the end. I'm sorry, it's a long name. But this has been shown that in rats, when they practice doing the wrong thing, they have the brain reorganizes to learn the bad patterns. And then the issue is, which was recognized in 1957 by Bernstein, who is one of the fathers of motor control theory, and Beretseva, a physical therapist who was working with him in Moscow, who mentioned that the system that learns how to adapt the wrong way, it's harder to undo that bad pattern to relearn a new pattern than to relearn to have a new pattern right from the beginning. So to undo a compensation is harder than learning a good pattern. So that's why we want to avoid compensations, if at all we can. Am I talking too fast? Everybody's very... Okay, so use dependent plasticity if the practice is good, not if the practice is just practice. Okay? So for example, I don't know if I'm going to get to it, but I better go. Okay. So we know that the best recovery is achieved through repetitive practice, so a lot of practice, more than we can possibly give, of functionally relevant tasks, ADLs, manipulation of objects, but add to that that we need, so this is the OT part and this is the PT part, we need to strengthen key muscles and movement patterns and task-relevant patterns in order to allow the person to use the optimal patterns or the patterns that we think are better for them in terms of recovery of normal movement. I'm trying to avoid the normal word, but I can't. So typical movement, okay? So are you familiar with this? These are the 10 principles of experience-dependent plasticity that were published in 2008. This is a wonderful paper. If you're interested in plasticity and about learning, motor learning, you should definitely read this. Teresa Jones is an animal physiologist. Jeff Klein, also an animal physiologist, but he's doing things in humans as well, and they're both interested in plasticity. Teresa Jones, by the way, is the one who described, and I'm so happy that they actually showed evidence for learned bad use. It was very nice, the rat. So these are the points that are important for experience-dependent plasticity. So we need to use it or lose it. So if you don't use an action, you lose the action. And we know that there's reverse plasticity, plasticity in two directions, right? So in order to improve it, you have to use it. It doesn't improve by itself, okay? But you have to use the task-specific training to increase the function. Specificity, it's another point that the The nature of the training dictates the type of plasticity. So if you, for example, if you're into athletics, I'm just going to shut down my computer here. I see it's on. If you train for muscle force, you'll get muscle force, and you won't get muscle endurance. So even from the point of view of the muscles, you need to be specific for the training. I wasn't sure it was going to load, so I kept my computer on, but I can turn it off. Okay, repetition. More than 10 trials, more than 100 trials, more than 1,000 trials. Okay, a lot. Intensity, it has to be hard, no pain, no gain. Time, we think that there's different forms of plasticity that occur at different times during training, and we think that the earlier we get to the system after the damage, the more change we might expect to have. Salience matters. The task has to be important to the person. It's no point in giving somebody who's a construction worker a computer task to practice. Give him a hammer, okay? Give him something that means something to him or her, right? That's salience. Age matters. The younger you are, the more plastic your brain. And transference, plasticity in one function can enhance acquisition of similar functions. So you should vary the practice. It shouldn't be just one type of action of a class of actions, like reaching, grasping, but you should have a whole bunch of different reaching, grasping in a class of reaching, grasping tasks. Okay, because the system needs to find its own solutions to the problems of movement, and it has to adapt those solutions according to the different ways that the objects are oriented in the environment and what they intend to do with those objects. Because movement is all about the affordances of the task. Yeah. I don't know what you mean. What do you mean? How does a plasticity overcompensate? I don't know about that, but it's very interesting. If you have a reference, I'd like to look at it. Because that is the question of what's normal for children who don't have ever experienced a typical... You're saying early acquired stroke, so they have a normal system, and then they have a stroke. I don't know. Yeah. I'd like to see that. Maybe you give them to me. Okay, and interference, the idea that training in one task might interfere with acquisition of a skill in a similar task. There is some evidence that if you, let's say, learn one task and you learn the second one, then the learning of the second task detracts from the learning of the first one. Okay, but we're talking about simple things like movements or speed, and we're not really talking about ADL type tasks as we describe them. Okay, so when we're talking about training, we have, let's say, this is a rather hierarchical view, very simplistic view of the system from the motor planning level to the task performance level. And if you look at the system, the nervous system, from a hierarchical perspective, you have motor planning, you have coordination or combination of different degrees of freedom or different muscle actions in a coordinated way. That's a higher order motor function, whereas just the production of force or isolated movement are lower order tasks. They're simpler and easier to identify or isolate. And, of course, muscle tone and reflexes affecting all of those levels. So we can do mental practice to affect motor planning level. Sensory motor approaches or robotics affect something in this level. Sometimes coordination. Not too many things are affecting coordination, in my opinion. Neurodevelopmental approaches like NDT or MoBath go from the bottom up traditionally, but now they're also oriented more towards the task, if you're familiar with those. And then there's task-specific training, which is interested in both motor planning, task performance, but doesn't pay much attention to what's going on in the middle. And that's maybe one of the criticisms of that, including CIT, Whereas virtual reality also does the same, but maybe has more opportunity to isolate or give feedback on how the movement is being performed. Okay? So, this is just, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't understand if you how it's actually quite separated between components. Like, this is OT.
Oh, did I say that? Not here. Before. An OT wouldn't focus on strengthening a muscle per se in the task. Or would you? I don't know. Would you?
We would.
You would?
Yes.
Okay, so then there. So
yeah,
then the.
Yes. Then we would isolate what is required for that.
So how do you separate PT and OT?
Don't know.
I think in the upper limits, I think the separation, I don't want to get into this debate because I don't have time today, but the separation is a little bit arbitrary and artificial, definitely artificial, because you're not saying that physios only do muscle strengthening and don't do tasks, because physios do tasks too. I mean, both approaches are similar in that they're task approaches, right? But I'm just saying that when you do task-specific training, you should focus not just on performance of the task, but also on the movement quality or how that task is being performed. Like, is the elbow low enough? Is the shoulder reaching high enough? Like, what are the elements of the degrees of freedom and how they're combining to do this task? Not just, is the task being performed? Because a lot of our outcome measures are not looking at that level. They're just looking at task completion and not task performance. Yeah, that's the quality question. I'd say both professions are not doing very well for that one. Yeah. You had a question? I think the lines are very fuzzy, and they should be. And, we can debate this. These are the practice guidelines, evaluation, and adaptation cycle of what we do or how we put into practice new ideas or best practice ideas. So first you identify your clinical area and your best practice. You establish a guideline. We established an international guideline evaluation group to take a look at all these guidelines that were coming from different countries and different professions. And we established a guideline appraisal process, because I'm going to show you the guidelines here and how these guidelines came about. And then we searched for and retrieved different guidelines and then assessed their quality, their currency, and their content. Currency is an interesting word. I'm not sure what that means. And then once assessed, they can be adopted or adapted for local use, because every reality is different, every clinical setting is different. And then you would ask for peer review. You send them out and you say, okay, do you agree with these? Even in Montreal, in Canada, we tested the uptake of clinical practice guidelines. We gave a number of hospitals the SCORE project. I don't know if Nicole told you about that. Gave a number of hospitals some guidelines on how to do acute care and follow-up care in stroke, and then we assessed how they uptook these guidelines, whether they did them or not. Okay. But then we got feedback from them about the guidelines, and then the guidelines could be adapted to the local situation and then finalized for the local situation and then endorsed and adopted and reviewed. Okay, so guideline process is a long process, and it involves a lot of people, especially starting from an interdisciplinary guideline group that's looking at the data. Okay, so from the evidence-based clinical practice guideline, the first thing that Bob Teasel will tell you is that stroke rehab works. Okay? And then once the stroke occurs, rehab offers the best opportunity for improving outcomes. So compared to no rehab, people who go through rehab are going to do a lot better. And there's lots of evidence from animal and clinical studies showing that there's efficacy. So there's lots and lots of evidence about that. And that there's more people in stroke rehab, and good care saves money and improves lives. So that's the good start part of the story. But this is the bad side, and you already have your slide there, and the evidence is being ignored. Okay, people are not uptaking the evidence. So when you guys go into the clinic, you're going to uptake the evidence, right? Because you've heard all about it. But it's just that it's very hard to get places to change. So they did a survey of best practices and decided that stroke rehab hasn't changed in 4 decades, even though the research has shown such amazing new ideas about training, and all of those guidelines for plasticity, those 10 guidelines. Stroke rehab is still undervalued and organized in an ad hoc fashion. Like the first important thing in the hospital is the hospital system, the medical care. And the stroke part is okay, that's second. Okay, the rehab part. It's not just for stroke, by the way. We're not rehabilitating at the right time, in the right place, or with the right treatment. And the system needs to change. So this is the battle cry from Bob Tiso. Okay. You haven't been, you didn't get this before from Nicole, did you, in this course? Okay, I just don't want to repeat this. All right, so the benefits of stroke rehab. So we know, we have lots and lots and lots and lots of research showing that stroke rehab units are good, that they work. That people who are placed in a stroke rehab unit do much better than people who are placed in a general ward. Why is that? It's because there's a confluence of expertise. Okay, from nursing, medical, clinical staff, everybody's focused on the same thing. People know stroke and they're all thinking the same way. Whereas when you're in a general ward, you have patients of different types and you don't have specialists who know, this is a stroke patient, we have to, and with neglect, we have to make sure to put stuff on the right side so they can see it. You know, small things like that. Milder stroke patients can be rehabilitated in the community without negative functional outcomes. We know that. But the key here is that there has to be rehab offered. People left on their own watch TV. Okay? They don't do exercise. Me too. I don't watch TV. I do all of this, clicking. So stroke rehab units are associated with lower mortality, a lower combined outcome of death and dependency, lower incidence of institutionalization, lower hospital stays, and lower costs. Okay? So then you're convinced? I don't show you all the evidence. And, of course, better functional outcomes. Stroke rehab, the earlier the better. This seems to be the general consensus, but again, I'm telling you, we don't have all the evidence to show that what are the critical time periods. There seems to be a general opinion that, the earlier is better, but we don't know if too early is good. There was some conflicting evidence that if you do rehab too early, you might end up with worse outcomes. So you sort of block plasticity because you're training specific things. But that was very few studies showed that. And now, but the debate is still going on. This is Edward Taube. Do you know this guy, Learn Non-Use? Okay, he started from animal studies in monkeys, and he studied deafferented monkeys. A deafferented monkey is a monkey who doesn't have sensory input, just so they don't get information about the quality of movement, and they can't very well monitor what they're doing because they don't have sensory feedback about their movements. But he wrote that an animal with one deafferented limb, so one limb is completely numb, tries to use that extremity but finds that he can't. So it gets along really well on three limbs, and this pattern of behavior is therefore strengthened. So continued attempts to use the deafferented limb often lead to aversive consequences. In other words, he fails, or he hurts himself, or he trips. So he says, if I use that limb, I'm going to trip, so I'm not going to use it at all. And that's the consequence called suppression of the behavior, and that's the monkey then learns not to try to use the arm, or limb. And this is the whole concept of learned non-use in 1968, okay? We're only really picking up on this in the last decade. It took us a long time. But, of course, the story is not that cut and dry. There's other little nuances to it. This concept of learned bad use. There's a name I can't say. Oliver Dashvili. Because I sort of block out the middle. I don't know why. I get the Oliver. Anyway, it's Ian Wishaw's group at Lethbridge in Canada. They were the ones to first describe learned bad use, which is learned maladaptive behavior. Maladaptive meaning behavior that's not leading to a good outcome. And it intrudes on performance and limits success. We don't really have evidence for that. We only recently got evidence from it from an animal model, but still we're lacking evidence to show that if you learn the bad thing, it's harder to learn the good thing after. We have to show the evidence for that. Anyway, that's my thing, but gestures, Gestures were frequently repetitive and included combinations not used prior to the stroke, so new patterns emerged. And then the increase or escalation in the number of gestures with recovery training suggested that the animals used excessive and inappropriate gestures that represented motor habits that substituted for and competed with successful movements. So they replaced successful movements. So another reason why we don't want the system to learn the wrong thing. So, back to earlier the better and the story about earlier. The brain is primed to recover early post-stroke. We know that. The first 3 months is the greatest period of recovery. Animal studies suggest that there is a time window, okay? But the animal studies, it's hard to make the connection between the animal, the delays after post-stroke in an animal model and a human model, okay? Because in an animal model, you can do a discrete stroke, very small, well-defined, and the animal can recover in a week, whereas for a human, it's 3 months. So the time frame may be a little different, and the type of stroke will certainly be different. But anyway, animal studies do indicate that early rehab is associated with better recovery, whereas late rehab is not. Whereas we do have a situation where in humans, late recovery is also possible. Okay. And there is a clinical association, so this is clinical outcomes, between early admission to rehab and better outcomes. So this is where this earlier is better, but still we don't know the critical time windows per se. Is it 3 months? Is it 3 weeks? Is it 6 weeks? Whatever it is. So here's some evidence for you. This is a very seminal study by Bernaski, and they did early enhanced therapy. They subjected rats to 5 weeks of rehab beginning at 5, 14, and 30 days after very small, isolated, or well-prescribed strokes. And the control animals, one group was in this beautiful, enriched environment where they could play with colorful things and jump on each other, and the other one was just a plain cage, okay? So not an enriched environment. And compared to the controls, the animals who were in this fun environment had marked improvement after day 5, moderate improvement at 14, and no further improvement after 30 days. Like I said, in humans, like we don't know what this 5 refers to in humans and the 14. Okay. So, and of course, they imaged the brain and found that there was cortical reorganization around the stroked site. Okay. So is that cortical reorganization around the stroke site, is that recovery at the neuronal level, or is it compensation? Not both, to make a choice. It can't be recovery, because recovery, maybe you're right about both, but anyway, it's not recovery of the cells that were damaged. Those are dead, gone. Okay, you can't recover those. But it is recovery in the penumbra, or in the area around the lesion, and the connections between that penumbra and the rest of the brain. So that in that sense, it's recovery. So, however, the system has to recover in a new way because the cells that were initially damaged are not going to come back. So the whole system is compensating for that loss of those particular cells. So what happens usually in the brain is compensatory, to adapt the brain for due to the loss of the cells. Okay. Okay, so some conclusions about early admission is that early admission results in reduced length of acute care, improved functional outcomes, which reduces informal care needs. Okay, the next issue, more is better. And not just more, but more of good stuff is better. You just don't practice anything, but you have to practice the good stuff, okay? So the practice has to be task-specific, task-relevant, salient, and all those other things that were on that list of what is task-specific, use-dependent plasticity. The concept of use it or lose it. So going back to this, here's the picture of the regular environment. Okay. They see these rats are not smiling. But I think that guy's smiling, this guy. Looks like he's smiling. So we know that enriched environments increases cortical representation with subsequent better recovery. And the key factors for promoting recovery include increased activity and complex stimulating environments. So it's using the environment for the specific task that you want. Lack of rehab. There's been a lot of studies about not giving an animal rehab and what happens is a decrease in the cortical representation and delay in recovery. So there's opposite direction effects also occur when therapy is not provided or withdrawn. So the role of intensity. The greater the intensity, the better the outcome. But again, I have a little caveat, and that is the intensity. The practice has to be good practice, not any practice. There's strong evidence for PT, OT, aphasia, treadmill training, upper extremity in selected patients. All of these studies that looked at intensity all show really good recovery. Here's an example. Upper UAB with UAB. This is constraint-induced. This is constraint-induced. This is something else. Okay. Anyway, the placebo group improves a little bit. Okay, and then in the training, actually, it was quite flat, and there was really nothing much going on post either. Whereas the two CI groups were much, showed a really large change during the training period, and that was maintained after the training does help. And the more training constraint-induced being considered as to one of the more intensive trainings, type of training. Do you know the constraint-induced therapy? So what's the classic constraint-induced? How many hours per day? Not 14. Is that the classic one? Is it 90%? 14 day hours? But the training, how much training? Shaping, training within that period of constraint. The constraint can be on all day, but how much training is there? It's 6 to 8 hours, okay? 6 to 8 hours, long time. It's like all day, so you need a lot of resources to do that. And it's training, it's shaping, it's trying to get the movements to be good movements. But there's been some modified models of constraint where they do 4 hours a day or 2 hours a day. And they found also quite good changes. Okay, so here's a study of Sonoda in 2004. It was called a full-time integrated treatment program, a new system for stroke rehab in Japan compared with conventional rehab. So conventional rehab was 5 days a week, and the other program was called full-time integrated treatment. And so it was 7 days a week. Full-time integrated treatment, and I think they did additional things like CIMT, and they did training with robotics and other things. They kept people busy much longer, much more intensive, and also 7 days a week. Okay, so of course the fit group, the group who had more training, had significantly shorter lengths of stays, and they were discharged with higher FIM scores and nearly double FIM efficiency scores. So it is possible to change things. I'm not sure whether this was chronic or acute patients. It must be chronic. It must be acute. But I have to go back and check. There's other studies that have shown poor patient participation. And again, this idea of intensity and how much is enough and how much are we giving and are people getting better with what we're giving. So Lenza et al. Found poor participation in PT and OT during inpatient rehab was very common. he's not the first. That's not the first study to show that. There's a study by Ang that shows that patients are idle something like I don't know the percentage, but a large percentage of the day. So there's a lot more access time. We discussed that already. And of course, the less you do, the less improvement you're going to have in gym scores. You'll have longer lengths of stay, etc. Okay, so let's hammer that point in around enough. This is another study about the lack of engagement of our patients by Bernhardt. This is around the world. Okay, this is not just here in Canada. It's not just in the U.S., but it's worldwide. In a therapeutic day, patients spend 50% of their time in bed, 28% of their time sitting, and only 13% of their time in therapeutic activities. It's pretty dismal, I think. Huh? Okay. So, how intensive or how clinically feasible is intensive therapy? So, this is a study by Catherine Lang. She's a PT from the U.S. She's at Washington State University at St. Louis. And she's trying to get to this intensity business. And she did a study recently published, trying to translate the doses that we use in animal studies to human studies to say, okay, how much intensity are we really talking about? So it was task-specific training in one-hour therapy sessions, and it was a proof-of-concept study. So they had 15 stroke patients, single-subject design, three pretests. So they did 1 hour, three times a week for 6 weeks, 18 sessions. And they did a post-test and a month follow-up. And they did mass practice of functional daily tasks, graded with individually progressed guidelines, with feedback, all that stuff, 300 movements per session in three specific tasks. So they didn't increase the amount of time per day, saying, okay, in the hospital we don't have much time, but in this time I'm going to do 300 trials, okay, instead of 30. All right, and they found that the average number of repetitions per session was 322. They were very well attended. They had low pain and fatigue ratings. People liked it. And the ARAT, there was an average 8% increase of post and follow up, which has a minimal significant difference of 6. So this was a clinically significant difference in the ARAT, which is an upper limb functional or activity level task. I think the full paper, no, I don't think I saw the full paper, but she did publish another paper recently about moving faster is better also for the upper limb. It just came out. But this argues that even in the limited time frame we have available for patient care, perhaps we can be much more effective by giving more treatment and more intensive, more repetitions. So more therapy results in better outcomes. It's more cost-effective. We have to pay attention to the actual amount of therapist-patient time and the time spent in activation. So how much time or how many repetitions are we actually giving in that time that we're available? More is not better. It's more targeted treatment, more salient treatment, more repetitive task-specific training is better. We can access patients' care or better patient care by having more therapy assistants and volunteers and provide more stimulating environments for people. Okay? So let's talk about task-specific training and maximizing recovery. We know that task-specific training, a stroke rehab, must be task-specific. And we know that more from understanding salience and motivation and personal factors. But we also know it from a motor control perspective, that if we practice a task that doesn't have a meaning, the system organizes or the system plans that movement very differently than if the movement has a meaning. Okay? Because the motor system is involved or concerned with producing movement in an environment. And the environment in which we are determines how movement is produced. It's a perception-action coupling kind of production of movement. It's not just move this, move that. It's not done at the angular level. It's done at the task level. Okay. So unless we can train elements of the movement within the task. This is the Karen Shepherd approach, and that's very relevant, a very, very good way of approaching motor retraining. So, like, this is summarized in this statement, that functional reorganization of the cortex is greater for tasks that are meaningful, that have a goal, so goal-oriented or goal-specific tasks, and not just repetitive actions. So just doing something with a robot over and over again is not going to get you doing anything better except that task with the robot. Okay? It's not going to transfer to anything functional. If we do compensatory approaches, maybe we'll get faster recovery, but it's not necessarily better recovery. I think we made that point. So the trends are moving away from BOBATH and other NDT forms because they increase length of stay, because it focuses more on how the movement is performed and not really so much the task specific. But the IBITA, which is the BOBATH organization, has changed their guidelines now, and they now include task-specific training, so that all the BOBATH concepts are now incorporated into tasks, and it's a much nicer, much more relevant kind of training. Are you familiar with the BOBATH approach? So the IBITA now, they call it task-specific BOBATH training, and it's really worth looking at. It's very, very relevant to today's world. So lower limb training. Oh, am I supposed to tell you about this? Maybe not. In the presentation, I didn't know I covered the lower limb. You want to hear about the lower limb?
No.
So this is a study by Outermans et al. In 2010, published in Clinical Rehabilitation. And they showed task-specific lower limb training, 44 patients, 2 to 8 weeks post-stroke, so they're pretty acute, subacute. And there were two types of circuit-based training. So circuit training means it's task-specific. So in the circuit, it includes things like stepping up, stepping around, walking sideways, and all. It's like it's set up in different places in the room, and there's different stations, and you practice stepping over here, and you practice hopping over there, and you practice standing on one foot and hitting a ball over there or something else. So it just makes it a little more fun. But here the idea was intensity. So there was a high intensity and a low intensity group. The low intensity group just focused on the leg control or sort of specific task with the leg, whereas the high intensity one had more gait related activities and more postural control things. So they played ball or hit bolo bats or something else, that maybe some dual tasking there as well. And the importance here was that they went 70 to 80% of the heart rate reserve. So they did an element of training there. Right, it was a little harder. And, of course, only the high-intensity group improved at all. The lower-intensity group didn't improve at all. It was just like everyday activities. They didn't challenge them enough. And they improved on these two tests, which is the 6-minute walk test and the 10-minute walk test. There's an extra T. Okay? So it means you have to sweat a little to get an effect. From neuroimaging studies, we know that greater the intensity of rehab therapies results in more activation in areas associated with function to which that therapy is directed. It's very specific. So intensity, we know this is absolutely, we know that's very clear. We know it just from exercise. Okay, let's make a little switch to outpatient therapy now. So we've finished the acute, I think we have all the guidelines now for acute and subacute and chronic rehab. In other words, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as there's enough of it, it's specific enough, and, I mean, you can always adapt it to patient goals and patient preferences and things like that, but you've got to get people active, moving, and engaged in what they're doing, and doing a lot of it, and working hard, and working a long time doing it. Yeah. I think there's things you might want to do to monitor difficulty. There's something called the Borg scale, which is a fatigue scale. So you could use the Borg scale. It's like a VAS. It says, okay, how tired are you? You know, and yeah, where's your cutoff? You know, and the best approach I've ever seen is one adapted by or presented by Carolee Winstein from USC. She's a PT, but she makes a contract with her patient. Okay, you as a therapist want the patient to work as hard as they can, okay? But, you know, go to your Uncle Joe and you say, okay, I want you to walk down to Sherbrooke and then around the block and come back, and then I'll say you've had enough. That's your goal, okay? His goal is, I'm going to take the bus, or I'm going to, you know, give me a lift, okay? So your thing is to make a deal with your patient. Say, how much do you want to work? This is how much I think you should work. How much do you want to work? How much are we going to compromise on? Sign it. I'm going to work this much, and this is what I'm going to do. The whole thing is motivation. The whole thing is motivation. You can't impose your guidelines on anybody. And that goes for anything. It's not just stroke rehab, okay? So you can use certain things like monitoring Borg, fatigue. You can monitor heart rate also, okay? And you can also, you get to know your patient as well. But your goal is to push them a little bit harder each time and to get them to push themselves. Transfer your great motivation to them. Then you'll succeed, okay? That's what the virtual reality is about, too. That's what the virtual reality is about, too. I wouldn't say we is the best thing to use, but it's something. And, yeah, it's better than... It gets to that part about the movement being a little more automatic. But you should watch it. I'll get to it. I mean, they're playing tennis, but they might be cheating and hurting their back, so you have to be careful. Anyway, that's another thing. I'll get to it in the second part. Yeah. 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 I don't know. I don't work with Borg scale. Does anybody work with it? I think 6 is moderate fatigue. Yeah. I don't work with fatigue, so I would be just taking a guess. I don't know. There must be some research on this somewhere. You can look it up. I really don't know. Yeah. Okay. Okay, can we move on? All right. So what about outpatient therapy? So a lot of people are involved in outpatient therapy. People can be discharged to home. They can be discharged to a rehab clinic and still come as an outpatient. We know that outpatient therapy improves at least the evidence. These are summaries from evidence, okay? None of these are just my statements, but they're coming from this EBR-SR thing. So outpatient therapy improves short-term functional outcomes and decreases hospital length of stay and costs. Of course, it decreases hospital length of stay because you're getting patients to go home, and then they're coming to the clinic for their outpatient therapy. That's much cheaper. There are similar results for people who are staying in the hospital and continuing therapy in the hospital, or those that go home and then come back to the hospital for therapy. So that's a really strong argument for outpatient therapy and for getting people out of the hospital beds. And aside, you know, there's a lot of reasons why you don't want people to stay in the hospital. We won't go into those two. Timing and intensity. It's hard to detect benefit because, again, you know, this whole argument, maybe we're not measuring the right things, the outcome measures. We have to choose our outcome measures. Outcome measures can be all over the place. They may not be sensitive to the things we're trying to measure. So we have to be very careful about our choice of outcome measures. And also the fact that outpatient therapy occurs later in the continuum, so the changes are not as great. They're smaller changes, but they're maybe occurring over a longer period of time. Oliver Sacks. What? You read his books. Neurologist who had a stroke, and he wrote this book, The Man Who Confused His Wife for a Hat. Mistook his wife for a hat. Anyway, he has a new one, just came out, by the way. He wrote a book a long time ago, and Becky Rita also, that 20 years post-stroke, he was still noticing changes. The system can always change, okay? So, I mean, we're talking about a plastic system. I mean, my system is changing too. I'm getting older. It does. So things change as you get older. But you can still have neuroplasticity all your life, your whole life. And so neuroplasticity may have certain great big windows, but it never stops. So let's not think of it like that. Okay. Community reintegration. doctor says you can come home when I'm up to it. So is that not true? Right? It's about the environment that the patient is in, whether or not, how he's going to do, all right? So he might be ready, but his caregiver may not be ready, or his community, or he might not have adapted the stairs, or he can't get into the bathroom or something. So you have to, you know, of course, understand this whole story. We know that better outcomes occur, a lot of attention has been paid to caregivers. And I think we have to engage caregivers right from the beginning and not just wait for people to go home. And Janice Eng did a wonderful study using the GRASP system. Have you heard about that? GRAASP. It's basically a coloring book kind of thing, guideline, and a bag of toys. Okay? And it says, step one, play with the ball 30 minutes a day. And step two, take the doodle pad and make large squares with your affected hand in two directions 160 times. Okay? Things like that. Tasks. This game, this bag of stuff and the book isn't given to the patient. It's given to the caregivers when the patient's still in the hospital. Okay? And they are engaged. They sign a contract and they're engaged to do this with their loved one every day and especially on the weekends while the patient's in the hospital. So you think they had better outcomes? So engaging the caregiver is important early. Okay. Skills training in basic nursing skills for caregivers results in less depression and anxiety and improved quality of life for both caregiver and patient. So we should have more courses. That's what stroke units are about. It's training caregivers to give good care, engaging their loved one, and you know, working together to get this person better. The more the social support you have, the greater functional gains you're going to have. Less depression, improved mood, and social interaction. That's a given, and that's not just for stroke, of course. It's for everything. Community support services are also very important. And we should include the caregiver in social support interventions. And this is all very nice in a North American environment, okay? But what about other places that don't have community resources? Okay, what about other places that don't even have outpatient rehab offered to patients, and patients after acute care go home and they get stuck in the back bedroom in a little village for, you know... Outreach is very important, and there's people interested in international health and international outreach in our faculty, and I mean all over the world, and we're trying to get the standards of care raised across the world, and that's what the international groups are for as well. We have a lot of work to do. Structure of care versus process of care. So here's the Canadian consensus on standards. These are consensus statements, okay? Early access to specialized interdisciplinary rehab, so that means stroke units. Early assessment for stroke rehab. Appropriate intensity for all disciplines. SLR, you know what it is? Speech language, okay? Available outpatient therapy on discharge, so follow up into the community, with community supports and secondary prevention. So these are like bullet points that we have to maintain. So, stroke rehab works, especially in stroke teams. We have to get the patients in early, and we have to treat them intensively, including on the weekend. We have to engage the family and the caregivers and create a stimulating environment. Put mirrors around. Give people what they like. Bring their pictures in. Bring their, you know, let their pets visit. I really think pets are important. Create stimulating active rehab environments, focus on meaningful tasks, and challenge patients. Get them doing what they want to do, not what you want them to do, okay? And if it involves something like gardening, then do a lot of this kind of stuff and get them a little pot and keep putting it lower and get them to work on it, you know, stuff like that. Stop assessing everything and treat. So limit the number of assessments. Outpatient therapy must be available, and the process of care is critical. Okay? So that's where you can find this information, and that has nothing to do with my group. I don't know why that's even there. So none of the stuff I showed you is from my group, so forget that. Okay. Did you open the second one? Okay, you can stand up and stretch, but I'm not letting you leave the room because I have only one more hour, okay? So stretch, stand up, turn around. Come on, stand up.
You don't leave the room.
I'm ready. You ready? Good. Okay, so now we're going to focus just on the upper limb. And we have seen this already. Okay, here's a list of therapies that we can do for upper limb. Now, Nicole told me you wanted to talk about therapy. Okay. So, we can do neurodevelopmental techniques we talked about. So, what's the basis of Bobath? Or NDT? Who's done a Bobath course? Okay. So you'll have to tell us. What's the basis of NDT? Is it a new one? Yeah. Okay. The basis of NDT is hierarchical. That the system is hierarchical and it's been damaged, and so there's a damage in that hierarchy. Hierarchy meaning, remember I showed you planning and then all the other levels going down. And the system, the idea is that you need to get to the lower levels before you get to the higher levels. It's developmental, okay? So you have to be able to roll before you can sit up. You have to sit up before you can go to four-point kneeling. You have to go to four-point kneeling before half kneeling, and half kneeling before standing, standing before walking, walking before running, etc. Okay? So the system works on a hierarchical developmental idea. Also, but it's based on the concept that the nervous system, that the damage of the nervous system is occurring at the lowest levels. So there's a problem with tone, muscle tone. There's a problem with abnormal reflexes, release of abnormal reflexes, inability to produce force, the presence of spasticity. So the focus is on treating those aspects and saying we have to normalize tone and we have to increase force before we can ask the system to do any movement. And it's been terribly criticized because of that. And I agree, it should be criticized because of that. Okay? The system is hierarchical, but it's not sequential like that. It's all integrated. So you can do a task, even if you have abnormal tone, but you have to take the tone into consideration. You have to work on the tone during the task. So the system, the newer approach to Bobath has changed. But this is a concept that is ingrained around the world. Aside from North America, most people working with stroke in the rest of the world do Bobath. Or a European equivalent or a similar thing is called Vojta. It's another kind of neurodevelopmental approach. And people are very proud of this heritage and they believe that it works. And I do believe it works too, but I think they just haven't shown the evidence for it. They're not sort of at the same level of evidence as other newer therapies are. So I wouldn't throw it out, but I think it needs to be reassessed in the light of a more rigorous experimental approach. Anyway, we'll get into that. Another approach is bilateral arm training. So Sue Whitall, for example, in the States has this thing called the backtrack. Have you seen the backtrack? Okay, it's It's sort of the basis. It's a little bit on mirror therapy. Do I have mirror therapy up there? Okay, it's sort of like mirror therapy. The idea, and people, you know what mirror therapy is? Mirror boxes. So I was at the American Physical Therapy Association meeting, and they showed this company has this mirror box that they sell for $69 or $70. And it's very cute. Normally, mirror boxes are basically a box of wood with a mirror in the middle, and you look, you do this, and you see that. You do this with your good arm, and it looks like your affected arm is moving. And so it fools your system into thinking that you're... It fools your brain into saying, ah, my arm is doing properly. It should be reorganizing that way, too. There's been some evidence for that. That might be effective. But, again, it takes a lot of training, a lot of training. But this neat thing was a little bit different and allowed the mirror, small change, allowed the mirror to be tilted a little. Because in a regular mirror box, in order to see the arm, you've got to do that. So you're doing this and not this. And this is a different posture, different movement, right? If you have to do that. And then this arm, you know, do it yourself. This doesn't feel the same at all. So this little adaptation allows you not to do that. I thought that was really cool. But the backtrack is basically you work. It's a bilateral thing. It's just this. That's what I don't really like about it, because it's just a repetitive repetitive, non-useful movement, non-purposeful movement. And I believe, from a motor control perspective, that all movement should be purposeful. And so learning this doesn't translate into anything you're actually going to do, unless you're doing this, like painting your wall with two brushes, I don't know. But they have shown that by training both arms together, there's better benefits to the affected arm than if you just train the affected arm alone. And there's other reasons for that. Again, motor control issues about how the system is wired and about the interrelationship and the interhemispheric control between the two parts of the brain. Another kind of therapy is enhanced or additional therapy. We discussed that a lot, okay? A nice environment, colorful walls, pretty pictures, a motivating environment, and more of it. Strength training. Strength training was always poo-pooed as being something that was, you don't need to do that in stroke. It's not a problem of strength. It's a problem of muscle activation. It's a problem of muscle restraint because of spasticity. But it's not a problem of strength. But that's not true. People are weaker because they're debilitated, because they've been in the hospital, because they've been lying around. So, you know, you take anybody in this room and you go two weeks to the gym and you'll feel a lot better because you'll be a little bit stronger, right? And all of that is really important for recovery, especially in older people who had a stroke. So strength training is important. Muscles are weaker, especially kids now. We're finding the CP kids. Diane Damiano and her group in the States have been focusing on this for a long time. And we have to strengthen the kids. The kids are just not getting out there, kids with CP. They're not being integrated into community programs. They're not doing the same amount of exercise. Regular kids aren't getting enough exercise. Imagine the CP kids are getting even less. So we focusing on training, strength training, fitness. Repetitive task-specific training is one of the goals or one of the main approaches. Trunk restraint has been used as a main approach for therapy. So the idea in trunk restraint, and I'm proud that I can say that I'm an honorary OT, because I have a chapter in the Occupational Therapy Handbook of Upper Extremity Interventions. And it's about trunk restraint. Okay, it was our group of studies. The idea is that it's like a forced use paradigm. So we noticed that when people are reaching, they're using their trunk a lot. Okay, children do it, adults do it. Okay. Now, using your trunk is important when your movements are precise. So if I'm doing some fine tricotage or something, I'm going to keep the movement, the task close to my body. I'm going to limit how far it is from my body. Or I'll bring myself closer. I'll use my trunk for that reason, okay, for precise movements. We find that when patients with stroke are reaching for things, maybe there's many different reasons why they don't get their elbow out or arm straight, and they're using their trunk a lot. But we found that if you restrain their trunk physically, saying, no, you can't use your trunk, and force them to use their arm, they can. They have the range of motion. They're just not using it. So we call it a force use paradigm, and we studied it and published a number of papers showing that chronic patients who did not incorporate range of motion into their reaches could, when given the right biomechanical situation, in other words, the trunk constraint, and if they trained with the trunk constraint and then removed it, they maintained this increased range of motion in their reaching. And we showed this in adults with stroke and in children with CP. And there's papers, about six papers published. So that's the trunk restraint approach. And I think the restraint approach can be used for any joint. It doesn't have to be just the trunk, although the trunk is the most obvious one. But if you want to restrain or not allow a compensation to happen, you've got to physically stop it. Okay? So maybe hip hiking. I don't know how you're going to stop that one, but you might wear a brace so they can't hike their hip. Okay? And in fact, people who wear back, people who have like back fractures and they wear a solid body brace, they can't hike their hip, and their gait pattern changes. Okay, they do less compensation when they're back. Anyway, we know that sensory motor training is important, and somatosensory stimulation is important. The more information from the periphery, the better. Things like TENS, sensory stimulation, FES. Or electrical stimulation, where you stimulate the afferents more. We do it tapping to facilitate a muscle contraction. We do quick stretch. We do quick ice. All of these things increase the sensory input to the somatosensory cortex, which then synapses with the motor cortex, and then movement is facilitated. And so we want to get the person engaging more this pathway by activating the sensory system. Mental practice. You've heard about mental practice? More and more evidence that this is really important, that the parts of the brain that are activated during ideation or thinking about movement are similar to those that are activated when you actually move, except for the motor cortex, which is the pathway out. Hand splinting, really important for hand positioning, for prevention of contractures, and for improving or facilitating functional grasping. So it's really important, especially in the early phases of stroke. CIMT we discussed already. Robotics and VR, again, many different applications, up and coming field, and I'll try to touch onto some of that in a minute. So here's another kind of picture of what we saw before, okay, where the motor planning is at the top, motor planning, movement production. There's some kind of transformation between what I want to do and how to do it. Okay, so that's at the thinking level or the ideation or the premotor area. Then we started over here with interjoint coordination, but there's also interlimb coordination between limbs when you're catching something, when you're doing something together, when you're using one arm as a stabilizer, another one as a mover. This is a coordination between limbs. It's a segment. It's a, we call it a coordinate structure. It's a unit of movement. It's not just one arm and the other arm, but it's both arms together. So all of this is coordination from the muscle level, the joint level, and the limb level, different levels. There's precision and dexterity, which I believe occurs not just in the hand, but in the, you can describe dexterous movement all over the body, including lifting your arm. A ballet dancer who lifts their arm looks much more smooth and graceful, graceful meaning dexterous, because they're able to isolate the movement of the shoulder from the movement of the scapula, whereas the rest of us schlubs do this, right? Force, and these are at the lower level. This is where the focus of the neurodevelopmental treatment is. So where do we get to these things? There we go. We did this already. And then strength training, FES, which is functional electrical stimulation, biofeedback, trunk restraint, sensory motor training, all of those things are trying to increase up to the level of muscle coordination, okay, to make muscles fire in patterns that are coordinated together. Then there's bilateral and robotic training. Maybe interlimb should have highlighted the upper one, but this is I vetted this particular thing in PT and OT groups around the world, and nobody has criticized it. I always ask people for their input, and they more or less agree with me. So this is pretty, I guess that's kind of nice that, you know, like when I first, I just did it, but I think as physios and OTs, we have different opinions, but I didn't find anybody who changed anything. Non-specific training, forced use paradigm, task-specific is focusing, like I said, on the task, but without really focusing on how that task is performed. So what are task performance variables? What are things you measure to see if a task is well done? Precision, speed, and smoothness. There's three. Okay? How fast it's done, how smoothly it's done, and how precise it is. Right? So usually those performance variables are identified at the effector level, at the hand, at the foot. Okay? At the bottom if you're sitting in a chair. Okay? These are movement quality variables. This is how the movement is performed. This is the what, fast, precise, and smooth performance variables. And this is the how, with a lot of elbow extension, with too much trunk movement, without coordination between the arms. Okay? So quality and performance, I separate them. Task-specific training and other things can be improved by practicing lost motor elements, where we focus on the task or the part of the movement, partial task practice, that wasn't able to be done. So if you're doing a reach-to-grasp task, and the problem is opening the hand for grasping, so you need to practice that and then incorporate it into the reach. But it's really hard to incorporate the reaching and grasping at the same time. So you do one part of it, and then you incorporate. It's called the partial task practice. Virtual reality training usually is looking more at the interlimb coordination, its whole body movements, its end effector, of course, but related to some task. But again, it's hard to give information about what's happening at a muscle force or a multi-muscle coordination, so you might have to give specific feedback about those things. Mental practice, on the other hand, is just at the motor planning or movement production level. Okay, so what about evidence? Is there evidence to support the effectiveness of different types of approaches? And I'm going to go again through the EBRSR. I don't have to tell you what the Pedro scale is, do I? Good. Or the levels of evidence. Good. Okay, let's start with robotics. I like robotics because it's a new field. The people doing robotics are mostly engineers. And they make better, faster, and more snazzy machines. Engineers build great cars, and they build great robots. But I think they missed the point a little bit with rehab, because they think that they're wonderful robots. Is this recorded? Even if I don't do that? Been a lot of robotics, changes in robotics and things that are fantastic that is happening in robotics, but I think it's up to us to identify what are the important parts of that robotic and how we can use it in our therapy, not to replace us, but to enhance us, okay, to make us better, to make our patients better. So it goes way back to 99 when the first studies came out, and they were really criticized. They used robots, active assisted. These robots basically... Okay, it looks something like that, okay? But it's usually a mechanical thing. And the robot basically enhances the movement by either assisting a particular movement, resisting it, or not doing anything, just supporting it. So there's some passive robots that just support the weight of the arm. And we know that if you support the weight of the arm, then movement production is easier. So what the robot will do is support the entire weight of the arm, and movements are done. And then... you can diminish the support and repeat the movement. So you ask the nervous system to take more and more control over that task, and then the robot starts to remove its control. That would be a really good robot. I'm not sure they all do it that well. Okay. One of the problems with robots is that a lot of them are, because of the mechanics involved, they're only making movements on a single plane. Okay. So like the MIT Manis or the Armio, are robots that only move in one plane, okay, X, Y. There's no up and down. Or if there is up and down, it can be up and down and X, Y, but it can't be both together. And we know that movements are 3D. They're actually 6 degrees of freedom, right? The X, Y, Z, and Fitch, Roll, Yaw, there's rotations, right? So it's hard for a robot to reproduce all of those, but you can reproduce some of them. And so the question is, by reproducing those and repeating them over and over again, are we going to end up with functional improvements? We might improve the actual task, but does that, bless you, does that translate into something functional? So at first, the early studies used the Fugelmayer test as a functional test, and they got blasted for that, but they didn't really know. Fugelmayer is not a functional test, it's just an impairment level assessment. So then they now they're moving a little bit more into the FIM and the ARAT and things like that. Okay, so it's coming. But the idea is repetition. Lower limb robot is much more, let's say, physiological feasible because our lower limb movements are much more robot-like. They're much more stereotypical. So you can do a stereo, but still you need to have a certain flexibility in order to walk over uneven terrain and things like that. So, but in the upper limb, the number of movements you can make with the upper limb is infinite, and there's no way a robot can repeat or train all of those movements. This is the problem with the upper limb rehab. Anyway, we'll get into robots later. But I'm just saying that the evidence looks like that. Okay, so what people do is you've seen the evidence on the EBRSR. Anyway, it's all in tables, and the RCT or non-RCT is identified. A Pedro score is given only if it's an RCT, and then the levels of evidence there's an idea about how many patients were involved, what they did, what the transfer, what the comparison was, and what the outcome was. So all of the green outcomes are good, and all of the black outcomes are not good. So it's really mixed up, you know, because the machines are all different too. So. Anyway, let's look at positive effects. This is Steve Wolf. I don't know if you know him, Steve Wolf. It's an older picture of Steve Wolf. He's now doing the Ironman marathon over 60. Yeah, he doesn't look like that anymore. So CIT, there's 49 RCTs. 49 RCTs for CIMT for the upper limb in stroke. And the conclusion is benefits those with some active wrist and hand movement. It's not such a strong outcome, is it, for the amount of effort that we put into studying CIMT? But it's become something that's been done now more and more. And I think it's been done because it's more popular and because there's more RCTs on it, because the other things have a lot less RCTs. Okay? But in order to derive benefits from CIMT, you have to have a minimal recovery level. They have to be able to lift your wrist with the elbow extended, okay? And that's really for protect, especially in kids. It's really, with kids also, you need to have protective extension to avoid falling. So it's really because, you know, if you're handicapping the system and you may be making it more prone to fall. Strength training improves hand function, 5 RCTs. It's interesting because early studies showed that strength training was very effective in the lower limb for improving gait, as you would expect. If you make the calf muscle stronger, you can have a better push-off and you can walk faster. But in the upper limb, strength training was shown to have no effect whatsoever because upper limb tasks are not strength-related. They're more dexterity-related. So being stronger, unless you're absolutely weak, being stronger doesn't help. Okay? But for hand function, being stronger is important, and that's what that point is about. Okay? For virtual reality, more and more RCTs now. This is an example of one of those robots. It's a planar robot, and the task is hit the little balls on the screen, a really functional task, I must admit, right? That's the criticism. It's not very functional. It's just like do this task and then see how much better you get at that task. So we know that at least for the studies that have been done for robotics, 32 RCTs have shown that this type of robotic training improves functional and motor outcomes for the shoulder and the elbow, which I think is really funny because I don't think there's a functional outcome for the elbow. There's a motor outcome for the elbow, you know, but movements are not done by an elbow alone. Functions are not done by a single joint. So that statement is funny. It should say improves motor outcomes of the shoulder and elbow. How that relates to function, still, it seems to be coming up. It seems to be interesting now, but still proof is necessary. For VR, this is a type of VR. It's called motion capture, where the person's is placed, the image of the person is placed within the scene. Okay. and then the person sees themselves interacting as a mirror image on a computer screen or on a big screen like this, okay, or on TV, right? The things you can do, balance training in a game situation. And this is similar to the flapping your arm around with the Wii, you know, that the person will make movements into ranges where they wouldn't do if you were standing there telling them to touch the beanbag. Okay, they won't do it. But if you tell them, hit the ball and make it turn into a bird and fly away, and then they get a score and they have to do it in a certain amount of time and they want to do it and they want to do better each time. So there's really a motivation for that. If you hit the bird too fast, it turns into a... If you hit the ball too fast, it explodes. So, and it goes... And you, so you have negative feedback, positive feedback. The drawback of this system is that it's 2D. You're in this plane. Okay? So if I do this or this, I'll get the same effect. Okay? The system doesn't track in the AP direction. Things are getting better. We're now using Kinect cameras instead of other regular cameras, but... Anyway, that's that thing. All right. Positive effects for Botox for decreasing spasticity and increasing range of motion and 30 RCTs. Botox, big time. Big time for spasticity. Botox, what is it? It's a neurotoxin, right? It paralyzes the muscle. Repeated Botox, it's a poison, actually. You repeated Botox and you damage the muscle so that you can only have a limited number of injections. One of our master's groups is looking at protocols for post-Botox injection for upper limb rehab and stroke as their master project this summer, so it would be very interesting to come and listen to them. I'm anxious to see what they come up with. But it's very popular now. And for those people with intractable spasticity who don't recover, who don't respond to medication for spasticity management, this is very good, very good effect. But it's very artificial in a sense because it basically paralyzes a muscle. It doesn't do anything to the nervous system, which is where the spasticity is coming from. Yes, it's transient. Yes. Yeah, every 3 months. Yeah, so it doesn't really help because it's every three times. It's a transient effect, and it doesn't affect the problem, which is the origin, of the neurological origin of the spasticity. It's affecting just the peripheral apparatus. It's like a dorsal rhizotomy, and which, well, it's better than that because it's transient. But there is some evidence that there is a long-lasting effect that outlasts the period of in that three-month period, you can do rehab. You can get the person to learn to activate their muscles better while the spasticity is reduced. So hopefully that will lead to better changes. It's not that you're not just reducing the spasticity here. You're improving the system's ability to interact with the muscles. So in that sense, it's... And Botox combined with E-stim, for example, shows to improve tone. But we know that E-stim alone improves tone, and we know Botox alone improves tone, so that's not very surprising. FES, functional electrical stimulation. So this guy's wearing electrodes that are probably attached to his wrist extensors, and when there's probably some timing device so that when the elbow reaches a certain amount of extension, the hand opens. Okay, could be, or it could be that when something touches the fingers, the hand closes. So you could figure it out. I'm not sure exactly what this picture is showing. But FES is a substitute for voluntary muscle activation for hand opening or hand closing. And it's shown to improve function. Obviously, if you improve the hand, you improve function, right? So there's positive effects for antidepressant drugs, short-term. And there's positive effects that show that antidepressant drugs improve short-term motor performance. We also know that people who are depressed don't learn as well, okay? And so when you're trying to motivate somebody and you're doing everything right for motor learning, if somebody's depressed, you're not going to have a good effect. So you've got to deal with the depression too, okay? And extrinsic feedback has been shown to be important to focus somebody not just on the internal feedback of moving, but giving them some cognitive task to focus on, like, you know, extrinsic feedback about elbow, you know, move your elbow more, you'll get it, and giving rewards for that, of course, is even better. There's uncertain or conflicting evidence or partial effects for the following. For enhanced therapy for short-term outcomes. There's no evidence so far that... there's no evidence so far that enhanced therapy, what I showed you before, this lovely cage, and more therapy and everything, we don't know about the long-term effects of that. We have evidence in the short-term that it's effective, but long-term it's not clear. For repetitive task-specific training, it's still conflicting. And there's 10 RCTs out there, but the idea is that it's probably conflicting because all the studies are different. And the how it's set up and how much repetition and what the task is and what the outcome measures are all different. So if you get the right combination of evaluations and outcomes, then you'll get a good result. But if you miss, you might miss something along the way. So we still need to do better research in that respect. Here's the backtrack. Now you can see how functional this is. These are two PTs, by the way. Jill Whittle and Sandra McComb-Waller. But this seems to have good effects, but it's still conflicting. I guess it has good effects on being able to do this, but the result is, does that help you do other functional things? We're not sure, okay? Trunk restraint, there's four RCTs. Three of them are mine. I guess one was Thillman. They did the same protocol, which is good. But this is a very cool trunk restraint system for a child, I guess, yeah. We need more research there, and so I try to sell that. I can't do all the research myself. Here's mirror therapy. There's level 4 conflicting or partial effects. You see how she has to lean over to see the hand a little? So she's tilting her head. So we know that head orientation and posture are important for movement production, and so we don't know that effect. Sensory motor training I talked about, thermal, intermittent pneumonic compression, sensory training, tapping, stretching, icing, all those things. There's 16 RCTs. Again, all kinds of different things are being studied, and it's not that systematic, and so we don't really have very good evidence. We need more evidence for that, too. TENS for motor outcomes has been studied in 8 RCTs. Most of the TENS has been studied for diminishing spasticity. So in these 8 RCTs, TENS has been shown to diminish spasticity. But in terms of the motor outcomes, that's conflicting. It's not clear whether diminishing spasticity alone improves motor outcomes. And that's what that is about. Mental practice and motor function in ADL, 14 RCTs, again, partial or conflicting results. Like, we still need more studies to show that. So you need to get, I don't know if you need a critical number of RCTs or you need a critical or a very better type of outcome measures or control groups. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different reasons. There's negative or limited effects on NDT. Now, this is interesting. This is Bobath again. Now, there's a lot of people out there doing NDT, but very few people measuring NDT. So probably the best NDT practitioners are not doing the studies. The clinicians are not doing the studies. The people who are doing the studies are researchers who don't really understand the clinical approach. That's another thing. And most of our outcome measures that are accessible in the clinic are not measuring the right outcomes because NDT is trying to improve movement quality. But most of our measures are not measuring movement quality. They're measuring task completion. They don't really measure how well the movement's done, how much elbow extension there is, how much weight bearing there is on the arm or the leg. So people who do research in Bobath should need kinematic assessment. They have to be associated with a lab, and they have to understand Bobath. There aren't that many people in the world who can do that. So that's probably why we don't have good evidence there. Robots, 32 RCTs. Very prolific, but still negative or limited effects. And it's really too bad, and it's really probably because the studies are done assessing only the effect of the robot. So think about it. I mean, you want to know what is the effect of eating a carrot in your diet, okay? So you'd have to eat only carrots. And then you say, okay, I became anemic, all right? So it's not because carrots are not good. It's because carrots alone are not good. And the thing with the robotics is the same. So you need to do the robotics and everything else to be good. So as an adjunctive therapy, it might be very effective. alone, it might not be. So that for these 32 RCTs that have negative or limited effects is just looking at eating carrots. Okay? So you know what I'm saying, right? Yeah. EMG biofeedback therapy is not superior to other forms of therapy. It's studied from time to time, sometimes very popular, sometimes not popular at all. Not many people are doing biofeedback, but it's a type of feedback, and we do biofeedback all the time by giving feedback to the person. We tell them they're not sitting up straight, or they should be trying to activate their muscle more, or relaxing their shoulder, or whatever. This is all biofeedback. This type of research is just using a machine to do that. It's either a GSR, like a galvanic skin response, or a little EMG probe on the muscle, and you try to diminish it. Okay, but certainly, again, I think there isn't enough research in how these therapies combine to promote improvement. And I don't think any one therapy alone is going to do everything. And therefore, we're not going to find huge effects. CIMT seems to have the most because, of course, it's combining a lot of different things. Anyway, hand splinting doesn't seem to improve motor function or reduce contractures. And that's an interesting study. I think we need better studies in knowing when to put the hand splint on, how often it should be worn, in what positions, etc. Intermittent pneumatic compression for relieving hand edema has not been shown to be not effective in 3 RCTs. And so, general recommendations in 2011 were that how you decide what to do depends on the initial level of impairment of the patient. So if somebody the initial degree of motor impairment has been shown, and this is really robust, to be the best predictor of motor recovery. So for those who are expected, according to all the models of prediction, to achieve a greater amount of motor recovery, then it's appropriate to blast them with therapy to do everything possible. But for those who are not expected to recover, then we should teach them how to compensate and just do the movement no matter how they can, okay? Even if it's not the right movement. So here we're talking about people who were plus, or I think the cutoff is 3 on the chidok. So if somebody has a 3 or greater on chidok, upper limb, arm section, then they should be encouraged to do therapy. If they have less than 3, like 1 or 2, if it doesn't change over the first month or so, I'm not sure if 3 months is fair to say. No, it's because acute care is like a few weeks, right? So in the first month, if the chidok is less than 1 or 2, then the person will not be going to therapy, and they will be probably encouraged to compensate, to learn compensatory strategies. So attempts to regain function in the upper limb should be limited to those individuals already showing signs of some recovery. So there we should assess, at least initially, on a regular basis, to see if signs of recovery are occurring. And, of course, intensive exercise is beneficial. Those were the recommendations in 2011. Who benefits? This is what we just said. Of severe patients with little or no movement on admission, 14% had motor recovery and 30% had partial recovery. Similarly, Quackle found in 2003, only 11% had complete recovery at 6 months of severe patients. So some severe patients can benefit. Okay? Some severe can benefit from therapy. So we should have to be very careful to monitor whether that person is changing. If they're stable over a period, then we can say, okay, we can stop. Who does not benefit? People with initial complete paralysis, so flaccid paralysis. People with visual field deficits. So it's just as important to work on the hemianopsia and the visual field deficits as it is to work on the movement. Because movement, again, is perception action. Movement is determined by how we perceive our environment. Those with cognitive deficits will not benefit as much because learning involves cognition. Those with neglect and those with visual inattention, because attention, again, is important for learning. So what's relevant for people who have severe impairment is that it's important to make sure that the person has a comfortable pain-free range of motion, that they that hygiene is controlled for, that they can you know, clean their body, that they can get their hand in their coat, you know, things like that. The positioning and handling and external support are important to maintain and to make sure that there's no contractures or shoulder subluxation, or you're not causing any pain by pulling them by the arm. You have to train people in their environment how to do the range of motion exercises. Very easy for that hand. I've seen so many patients who have contractures because they have a lot of spasticity. Okay, and you know, perfectly normal kind of functioning person, and he's out and he's running around and his arm's like this, and he can't get the wrist back and he can't get the elbow down, and his wife is sitting there, and I said, well, are you just stretching? Oh, okay, yeah, whenever we remember to. I said, you have to stretch every day, you know, you have to maintain the range of motion, because it's just going to get worse, and it can get absolutely blocked. Have you seen people with contractures? They're absolutely solid. Okay, so you can prevent all of that. Anyway, for people who are very severe, you want to teach compensatory techniques and adapt the environment so they can perform to the best of their ability and do everything with their less affected hand. For those people who have moderate impairment and are highly motivated, then you want to engage them in repetitive, intensive use of novel tasks that challenge the patient to acquire necessary motor skills of the involved upper limb during functional tasks and activities. What we've been talking about all day, right? So, and motor learning training, including the use of imagery. So everything possible. I don't believe we should only do one thing. I think we should do everything, and we should do the things that the people like, and we should motivate them and rotate them, move them around. Okay, one last point, and that is the we. I didn't manage to talk about it. So the we and the connect are really have moved into the rehab scene, and that's really good because it provides a way of delivering more therapy time. However, let's not make a mistake. The we is not therapy, okay? The we is a game, right? It's not adapted for therapy. It doesn't have any of the goals of therapy involved in it, okay? The only thing it does is allow the person to move more, okay? But, you know, you can cheat like crazy with the Wii, right? You can play tennis like this. You don't have to do that at all. You'll still win, right? So it's very important to monitor what's being done with if you're using it as a therapy. If you're not using it as a therapy, if you're just using it as, okay, let's move a lot therapy, that's okay. But it's flailing your arms around. And we don't usually do this kind of stuff unless you're waiting for a bus, okay? But this is not movement. This is not goal-directed movement. So if you want to teach reaching, you can, you know, we were using the pool game in Wii, okay? The pool game, you have to do this, okay? Because we wanted to do like a punching thing, all right? So you have to get lined up. But you can totally cheat, okay? So the Wii has to be monitored. Somebody should be there you know, if you're using it as a means of training a specific action. I think we have virtual reality applications now. They're popping up like mushrooms all over the place, okay? Companies. Everybody wants to jump on this bandwagon because of Wii. The Wii is used because it costs $300. The other things, like the Gentronics, the RFP system, the PIT system, there's all kinds of them now. They're on the cusp of being commercially released. They're just coming out. These systems are going to be between, let's say, $2,000 and $5,000. The IREX, this with the putting yourself in the scene, is $10,000. Okay? So clinics, the clinic has to be convinced that this investment is worth it. So the research has to be out there. And there it's coming. It's coming. And all these other new systems that are coming up, a dime a dozen, they have to be tested too. Okay? So we're a little ways off before we can say this is going to be worth your $5,000 investment. In the meantime, here, $300, you have a toy. Okay? But you can use the other one we used before that was the Sony iToy, you know? It's not cool stuff. So if the idea is just move, you could, the more the better. Just use everything. But you don't, again, you have to be careful. You don't want to encourage bad habits. That's the only thing. Okay? Questions? I have 10 minutes. You ever stop somebody from training because they might get a shin splint? It's their own choice. Obviously, you're there to provide counsel when the patient is an inpatient. And there are certain risks. There's other risks involved with playing the Wii. One is hurting themselves because they're not paying attention to what they're doing. And there's been reports of fractures. Yeah, yeah. And somebody who fell down, I don't know. Yeah. So these are usually offered in the recreation department, and there's usually a recreation person there. So it would be their responsibility to make sure. They need to be monitored, of course. I don't think you risk people working too hard. It's more, yeah. Right. Yeah, so, I mean, maybe you would recommend doing things that are within the person's capability. You know, obviously you have to use common sense. Yeah. But you know those air hockey games? They usually in the recreation department, too. They're in, you know, you don't want somebody to do puzzles all the time. You do them other stuff. Yeah. See, I don't call it rehab. I call it play. People call it virtual reality. It's not virtual reality. It's a game. It's a video game or a computer game. It's not virtual reality because you're not. Virtual reality has to meet certain criteria. One is that the environment should be immersive, and there has to be a sense of presence. So you could say that when you're playing tennis on the Wii, you feel like you're on the tennis court and you're playing tennis. So in that sense, you're immersed in the activity. But it also has to be adaptable and provide feedback to the user that's useful. That's the key, okay? So there's no feedback offered in the Wii aside from you got the score or you didn't. But we're more interested in, or as therapists, we're interested in how you did it, right? Did you extend the arm enough, okay? Or did you cheat? Right, so here you in the Wii, you certainly get points for cheating. So that's what has to be monitored. Okay, so I don't call it therapy unless the therapist is there. I'm going to make a beeline for the airport now. You guys okay? All right. If you have any other issues or questions after Friday, contact me. Thanks for logging on. Whoever did it, was it you?
Yeah, we can try it.
Just to see if it's okay. But
then you come, Joanne, by the way.
Hi,
nice
I'm
to meet you.
You.
Nice to meet you.
See you.
Yeah.
I was not sure how to pronounce your name.
It's more or less.
What nationality are you?
I am from Montreal. I'm born in Burrellvik here.
My parents too.
Yeah, I'm born in Burrellvik. My parents were. I was going to use some files on this computer.
I'm not a fan of being hooked up to a camera and everything.